Hello, the headlines today. China has released one of its best-known political dissidents and sent him into exile in the U.S. His brother tells us that Wei Jingsheng will now be able to get the medical treatment he needs and will continue to oppose the Chinese authorities. As the American Secretary of State begins talks with Gulf leaders on the crisis over Iraq, Kuwait has said it would oppose military action against Baghdad. We'll be asking if, in the absence of regional support, the Americans can really contemplate action against Iraq. The death has been announced in France of the veteran communist leader Georges Marchais. Also in the programme, has the shine come off Britain's new Labour government and cleaning up the seedy side of New York, but what's left?
Well, it's cleaner, it's safer, but I don't like it. It's too sanitary.
The news today is read by Michael Poles.
China has released one of its best-known dissidents, Wei Jingsheng, from a 14-year jail term for sedition and sent him into exile in the United States. Mr. Wei has always maintained he wanted to stay in China to reform the system from within, but his family say he has agreed to go abroad because of serious health problems. They say he hasn't given up hope of returning to continue his campaign for democracy. Carrie Gracie reports from Beijing.
Wei Jingsheng is China's most famous prisoner of conscience. He spent most of his adult life in prison, stubbornly refusing to retract any of his demands for democracy or sign any of the self-criticisms placed before him. He's been an ever-growing embarrassment to Beijing. He's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and his prison writings have been published in English. The United States has repeatedly demanded his release, and when President Jiang Zemin visited Washington a few days ago, Wei's case came up again in meetings with members of Congress, and there was a robust exchange about human rights between the two presidents at their joint news conference. American officials clearly expected some concession from Beijing to justify the Clinton policy of engagement with China. Now they've got it.
Kuwait has declared it is opposed to any military action against Iraq to force it to comply with United Nations demands over weapons inspections. The call for moderation from the Kuwaiti foreign minister came as the American Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, began consultations with America's Gulf allies as she continues her tour of the region. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Jim Muir.
Mrs. Albright is finding out the hard way just how much things have changed since 7 years ago when the Western coalition went to war against the Iraqis to drive them out of Kuwait. Then they had the active support of a group of Arab states which even sent troops to help. Now even Kuwait itself, while blaming Saddam Hussein for the current crisis, is making it clear that it would not support an American attack on Iraq. After talks with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Cairo, the Kuwaiti foreign minister said that any hostilities would harm the Iraqi people as well as Iraq's neighbors. Mrs. Albright attended the opening of a regional economic conference in the Gulf state of Qatar, where she bitterly attacked Saddam Hussein, accusing him of lying, deceiving, and obstructing for the past 6 years. But the conference, much touted by the Americans and attended by Israel, has been boycotted by most Arab states, including many of America's traditional allies, in protest at the stalling of the Middle East peace process.
Clashes have broken out in the West Bank town of Bethlehem between Palestinian youths and Israeli troops. They erupted after the funeral of a 7-year-old Palestinian boy who died yesterday after being shot in the head by an Israeli soldier during incidents earlier in the week. Reports from Bethlehem say demonstrators at a refugee camp on the outskirts threw stones and bottles against security forces guarding a Jewish holy site. They responded with tear gas and stun grenades. The former leader of the French Communist Party, Georges Marchais, has died at the age of 77 from heart disease. The son of a coal miner, he remained faithful to old-style communist dogma throughout his life. Mr. Marchais was Secretary General for the party for 22 years until 1994, during which it steadily lost support and influence. In a period of widespread change in the communist world, Mr. Marchais's critics said he was never able to break the links with Moscow and recast the French party in a more modern form. A referendum is taking place in Hungary on whether or not to join the NATO alliance. Of the three former Warsaw Pact countries that have been invited to join NATO, Hungary is the only one holding such a referendum. Nick Thorpe in the capital, Budapest, says voting is likely to be in favour. The government's biggest fear is that not enough people will take part.
At a polling station close to the BBC office in the Angyalföld or Angels Field district of Budapest, polling was brisk from the early morning, with queues of voters sometimes forming outside. This is a predominantly working-class district of the city, and if the pattern is repeated across the country, the government's fears of a low turnout will prove unfounded. For the referendum to be valid, at least 25% of registered voters, 2 out of 8 million, must vote in the same way, either for or against NATO membership.
Pope John Paul has opened a synod of 230 Roman Catholic bishops from Latin America, Canada and the United States, the first such meeting of bishops from the Americas. Speaking at Mass in St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, the Pope said the synod should review the state of Christianity in the Americas. The bishops will advise the Pope on the challenges the Church expects to face in the next century. These include the defection of Roman Catholics to evangelical groups and a shortage of missionaries. Leaders of 49 French-speaking nations have ended their meeting in Vietnam with the adoption of a set of objectives, the Hanoi Declaration, intended to transform the group into a more effective political and economic movement. The BBC correspondent in Hanoi says trade and economic cooperation are given high priority, but the main emphasis is on playing a more assertive political role. The meeting elected the former head of the United Nations, Boutros Boutros-Ghali, as the group's first Secretary General. BBC World Service. Now back to Max Pearson.
Thanks, Michael. It would seem to be proof that constructive engagement works. A little over a week after China's President Jiang Zemin met President Clinton in Washington, China's most prominent dissident, Wei Jingsheng, has been released and put on a plane to the U.S. Nearly 2 decades of imprisonment, often in solitary confinement, has taken its toll on Mr. Wei's health. At the age of 47, medical parole is being given as the official reason for his release. Whether it's as a result of politics, diplomacy, or compassion, Mr. Wei's family in Beijing have been delighted by today's news. This was the reaction of his sister, Wei Lin.
He spent 18 years in prison. We all suffered mentally and emotionally. Now that he has his freedom to escape all this torture, we all feel happy for him.
And Wei Jingsheng's brother, Wei Xiaotao, said that the dissident's release may, in the long run, allow him to continue his opposition to the Chinese authorities.
He thinks this is an opportunity to get decent medical treatment, to have a good rest, and to have some time to think and read, so that in the future he can fight for his ideal again.
Relatives of Wei Jingsheng speaking in Beijing this morning. And on the line now from Beijing is our correspondent Duncan Hewitt. Duncan, to what extent was this release of Mr. Wei a surprise?
Well, there had been a lot of speculation that he might be released. People in the last few days had been hinting this, including the American ambassador, and it was being linked very directly to the visit to the U.S., as you suggested, by the Chinese president, Jiang Zemin. So people were thinking it would happen, but his family said they were surprised by how quickly it happened.
What, if anything, do the people of China know about these events?
Well, things like this are not publicized generally. There was one very brief report on the English service of the official Chinese news agency, which said that Wei Jingsheng had been released for medical reasons. It didn't actually go out of its way to say who Wei Jingsheng was. There may possibly be a very brief reference to it in the papers tomorrow, but that will be a procedural thing. China doesn't like to give these people the oxygen of publicity, if you like.
He is the dissident who is perhaps best known outside China, but what sort of support and standing does he have inside China?
Well, as I say, he's not a household name throughout China, but he is very well known, particularly among urban intellectuals and especially the younger generation. And many, I think, of the student generation of protesters from 1989 have looked up to Wei Jingsheng as a kind of spiritual leader. So he's somebody who perhaps has inspired those younger people. But his departure may well go unnoticed by the vast majority of the Chinese people, and that's what the government wants, of course.
He is also, of course, not the only dissident. What about others? Other prominent names like Wang Dan? What's happened to them?
Well, again, Wang Dan was thought to be on this kind of shopping list, if you like, of concessions that the U.S. wanted to see from China. And there's speculation, too, that he may be released soon, although his mother said today that she didn't have any information about that. But it may well be that he's released either immediately in the next few days or in the run-up to President Clinton's planned visit to China next year. But for the vast majority of dissidents, I think this kind of high-level international acclaim and pressure which builds up is something that they could only hope for and long for, but are not very likely to see in the next few months.
Duncan Hewitt, live from Beijing, and with me in the studio now is the BBC's senior Chinese affairs analyst, James Miles, who's met Wei Jingsheng in person. I mean, first of all, how important a figure is he in the dissident movement, and what sort of person?
Well, very important indeed, and that was, of course, highlighted by the kind of sentences that the Chinese government imposed upon him. The 15-year sentence they gave him for his activities in the late 1970s at Democracy Wall. He was released 6 months early as a key concession in 1993 by the Chinese at a time when they were bidding to hold the Olympics in the year 2000, a bid that eventually failed. And 6 months later, Wei Jingsheng was put back in prison, jailed this time for 14 years. Very heavy sentences. And I think a sign that the authorities were particularly worried about his activities after his release in 1993, when suddenly dissidents became encouraged by his release, saw him as a kind of figurehead, and the government realized that the very fractured dissident community might coalesce once again if they didn't put him behind bars.
I've read some suggestions that he has, in the way he's approached dissent, been somewhat aggressive and very hardline and somewhat provocative to the authorities, and as such, he might not have been approaching the issue in the best and most productive way.
And that made him rather unusual among Chinese dissidents, many of whom don't like to take on the government directly, attack Chinese leaders by name. One reason it's speculated that Wei Jingsheng fell afoul of the authorities in such a manner, was put away for so many years, is because he directly attacked Deng Xiaoping in the late 1970s, at a time when Deng Xiaoping was enjoying enormous popularity after the fall of the Gang of Four, the radical change in government policy towards a more liberal economic climate, certainly. Wei Jingsheng took on Deng Xiaoping personally, attacked him as a dictator, and said that democracy had to be achieved before any other kind of change.
All right, well, what should we read into the timing of this release? I mean, clearly there is the assumption that it's associated with the visit to the US last, just over a week ago, by President Jiang.
I think it's almost certainly connected with that. Of course, the Americans are not saying that publicly, and the Chinese certainly wouldn't say that publicly. They would be the last to say that they've made any concessions to American public opinion. But if it is a concession, it's not that big a concession, because this is part of Chinese government policy, or has been part of Chinese government policy over the last several years, to send these dissidents abroad, if possible, so that they join the exiled community, which, in Beijing's view, is a very weak force, not the one they feared would come to being after the Tiananmen Square protests. And so they fear, I think they have little to lose.
I suppose the key question is, does this represent a softening of policy towards dissent in a general sense on the part of Beijing, or is it simply the playing of one card, if you like, by the authorities?
I think in China generally, although there has been an easing up on several fronts in the last few years since Tiananmen, one thing that really hasn't changed is the ability of people to openly attack the government. And the very small dissident community in Beijing and Shanghai and one or two other cities, consisting really of only a very tiny handful of people, is very closely monitored by the government. The few that are around are tailed by secret police whenever they go out, and there's really no sign of change as far as freedom of speech is concerned, really.
James Miles, thanks very much for joining us. It's nearly 13:14 GMT. In a moment, Tony Blair tries to clear the whiff of sleaze which has enveloped the British government, and is the Catholic Church in the Americas in crisis? You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. A reminder of the headlines. As we've just heard, China has released one of its best-known political dissidents and sent him into exile in the United States. And as the American Secretary of State begins talks with Gulf leaders on the crisis over Iraq, Kuwait has said it would oppose military action against Baghdad. Now, the Kenyan authorities have set a date for presidential and parliamentary elections. They're to take place at the end of the year, on the 29th of December. For the first time, a woman will stand as a presidential candidate. Charity Ngulu has, not surprisingly, the support of many women, because she's seen to be addressing the issues which male politicians ignore. In the first of her reports in the run-up to the December vote, our East Africa correspondent Kathy Jenkins has been hearing some of those concerns from the women of Kenya.
The men were not for it so much, because when they heard we should only help girls, they were not much for it. But as women, we saw that it is the girl who is suffering and the child.
Grace Amingo runs an unusual school. It's in one of Nairobi's sprawling, poverty-stricken slums. The classrooms are a series of corrugated iron kiosks where you'd normally expect to find odds and ends being sold. Alongside the children, young women catch up on an education they never had.
This is a lady who was employed as a maid in the house. And when we approached our boss, the person who has employed her, we talked to her, and before she refused to release her to come to school. And we told her, let her come to school with the child, so long as she can learn and at least have this basic education.
Dawi.
Nyoka.
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 In this part of Nairobi, there is massive unemployment. Many women are single parents. Prostitution is high, so it's believed are the number of AIDS-related deaths. The school project can only help a few. Pharaoh Sanienda is a single mother with three children. She gets up at five every morning to sell vegetables. Twice a week, she comes to school.
I'm trying to learn how to bring them up in case I can get at least some work somewhere. At least I can bring them up.
Education is one target area for groups trying to help women in Kenya. Work is also being done to raise women's awareness of their human and legal rights.
Most women believe that it's the right of the men to beat up the women. And for some tribes like the Luo community, which I come from, they believe that if you are not beaten by your husband, then your husband does not love you. And all the women have been socialized to believe that, especially in the traditional setting.
Jacqueline Anam is a lawyer who often leads seminars for women in rural areas. She has to be sensitive because many of the customs which violate human rights are traditions defended by women as much as men. In Kenya, a number of top women lawyers have decided to devote themselves to women's issues. Like Jacqueline, Millie Odihambo works for the International Federation of Women Lawyers, FIDA.
I've been a lawyer since 1990, but an advocate for the last 5 years. It was important for me to join FIDA because I would be able to use my profession in a meaningful way to help women, because I've always been interested in human rights issues, and especially women's human rights issues, because women are downtrodden in the country, and they are more often than not treated like second-class citizens.
Are we alert? Are we alert?
A conference in Nairobi. The participants are being trained to watch out for possible harassment of women candidates in the forthcoming election. It's being run by aspiring female politicians of the future, like Cherotich Sai.
Much as it is a reality that many women are economically, socially, politically, culturally, religiously downtrodden, I think we need to also begin to look at the other side of Africa, where you have women from all socioeconomic backgrounds who are working hard, who have come out, who have made it.
For the first time, Kenya has a female presidential candidate. Charity Ongilu has won praise for the way that she has risen above the gender-based smears. Student activists like Betty Obiero and Cherotich Sai admire her, but say that the next generation of female politicians won't wait so long before entering the political arena.
My main one is 2007, when I want to become a member of parliament for my constituency. And then I will not wait for as long as these women will wait, because I already have the information. I am empowered and I'm lucky in the sense that I was born in this day and time when things have gotten better, and it's my opportunity.
I just think it was a shame that these women had to wait for so long. But we are coming out, we are in our early, mid-20s, and we will be there come the next general election.
That report from Kathy Jenkins. And in tomorrow's News Hour, we'll be looking at what Kenya's Asian community wants from the elections later this year. Here in Britain, it's been the worst week of Tony Blair's prime ministership. The new Labour government, elected last May in part on a wave of public concern about government sleaze, has found itself surrounded by the whiff of impropriety. The issue has been tobacco companies' sponsorship of sport. The problem has been the decision by Mr. Blair's government to exempt Formula One motor racing from a ban on tobacco sponsorship, coupled with the revelation that the Formula One boss, Bernie Eccleston, had given £1 million sterling to the Labour Party. As the story leaked out during the week, Mr. Blair announced that Labour was to give back the donation. But then it was learned that party officials were in discussion with Mr. Eccleston about another donation. Well, within the past hour, Mr. Blair has been on British television in an attempt to clear the air. And right from the off, Mr. Blair candidly admitted that the government had not dealt with the issue well.
It hasn't been handled well, and for that I take full responsibility, and I apologise for that. I would never, ever do something wrong or improper or change a policy because someone supported or donated to the Labour Party. I didn't in this case. You know, I guess I should have, you know, we should learn the lesson of that. And when something like this happens again, you deal with it quicker in a better way. And we should have done that.
And Mr. Blair was clear about one aspect of this story, and that is that in his view, the Labour government has acted with greater propriety than the previous Conservative government would have.
How many times before now has any political party ever consulted the watchdog, got his advice, published it, followed it, turned away further donations? So we've not merely exempted Formula One, we've actually lost the Labour Party a considerable sum of money because we took the right policy decision.
Tony Blair answering questions within the past hour. With me in the studio now is George Jones, political editor of the Daily Telegraph, who's been watching the whole of that interview with the Prime Minister. I mean, this was New Labour's playing its trump card, if you like, in the shape of Mr. Blair himself. I mean, has it worked? Is the air clear now?
Well, he has certainly gone on television, said he was sorry, and issued an apology. And I think to most people out in the street who don't follow the minutiae of this whole business, I think that will go a long way to satisfying them. It is rare for a politician to go on nationwide television and say, I'm sorry, we got something wrong. And I think he's hoping that that will restore faith in his basic integrity and honesty.
But I gather from what you're saying that you believe that part of the questions surrounding the minutiae have not yet been answered.
No, there are still a lot of questions that remain to be answered, you know, about when various statements were made, when things were turned down. But as I say, I think that is something for the sort of the journalists. It will still carry on. People will still carry on and digging. I don't think he's put the whole issue to bed, but I think he has made a pretty clean breast of things and come forward and said, we got this wrong, I'm sorry. And as I say, politicians don't often say that. The previous government didn't say that. And I think Labour is trying to sort of say, when we do get things wrong, we apologise.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to look at this with the benefit of hindsight in some months. But, I mean, how damaging do you think this has been to a government which had this rather squeaky clean and shiny new image?
Well, it has been very damaging on that image, because there is no doubt that Tony Blair's honesty, his integrity, the fact that he was promising something from a tired, sleazy Tory government which was thrown out of office, that was his central appeal. And that has been tarnished by the perception, nobody's actually proved any wrongdoing, but the perception that money from this Formula One boss, Bernie Eccleston, managed to get sort of favours from the government in extending the period of exemption. As I say, it is a perception of wrongdoing rather than actual proved wrongdoing. But it has damaged him on that, and it has also, I think, marked the end of the honeymoon for Tony Blair, certainly among the media. There is no doubt that newspapers and broadcasting organisations are now focusing on the government, trying to sort of unpick things and prove that the government has been up to no good.
At the heart of all this is the question of party funding, and it's a curious political row in the sense that the Conservatives know that they also have a problem with this question of party funding, and therefore they knew that during the past week they couldn't really go full tilt at the Labour government.
Yes, they have, their hands are not clean, they have dubious sources of finance, and they don't really want to get into an argument about that. And Tony Blair has been able to throw that back at the Conservatives. But what has been interesting is it's not been the Conservative opposition which has been making the running in this. It has been the media, and it has been some of the newspapers which have normally been traditionally supporters of New Labour, who feel, as it were, let down by what they think has happened. And that is, I think, the sort of turning point that we've now seen, is that no longer is this viewed as a popular winning party. It's viewed as a government, and its mistakes can be pulled apart by the media.
And also, very briefly, in the long run, the issue of party funding is going to have to be addressed in this country.
It will be, and Tony Blair indicated in that interview that he wants the names of donors published, perhaps how much money they give, and perhaps an overall limit on the amount that political parties can spend at a general election.
George Jones, political editor of the Daily Telegraph, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Now, the veteran French communist leader Georges Marchais has died in Paris at the age of 77. Marchais was a towering figure on the French far left. He led the Communist Party for more than 20 years and remained stubbornly fixed to communist ideology and to the word communism long after the collapse of communist regimes in the Soviet Union and the rest of the Eastern Bloc. The current leader of the communists, Robert Hue, said he was shattered by Georges Marchais' death.
La mort de Georges Marchais me bouleverse. Et je sais la tristesse des communistes.
I know what sadness the communists are feeling. They deeply respected this man, this leader. He gave so much of himself to his party, he represented them for so long in national and international political life, and he was treated so unfairly. What we all remember is his generosity, his fighting spirit, which shaped this quite original public figure, this style which was his alone.
The words of Robert Hue on the death of his predecessor, Georges Marchais. Monsieur Marchais only retired as Communist Party Secretary General in January 1992. Philippe Chatenay is the foreign editor of L'Evénement de Jeudi.
The Communist Party in France remained powerful perhaps longer than in other European countries, and so Mr. Marchais was a very important player on the political scene, especially in terms of alliances with the other parties of the left, notably the socialists. So he, to a certain extent, really shaped the policies of the left in France for many, many years.
How did he manage to maintain that grip over the party and that grip over the party's thinking at a time when clearly opinions about communism were shifting in all other parts of the world?
Indeed, but Mr. Marchais really embodied faith in the Soviet model and blind obedience to orders from Moscow, and perhaps using the same methods as, say, Leonid Brezhnev in Moscow, he was able to maintain an iron grip on the apparatus of the French Communist Party, and only after his departure as General Secretary in 94, were there any signs that the French Communist Party was moving away from Stalinism and was beginning to admit that perhaps the communist system was not the best idea in the world?
And he was, I think, unique in the Western world for his public support of the 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and his long-standing support for Ceausescu in Romania. I mean, how did he manage to do that when all around him the tide must have been flowing the other way?
Indeed, but I think Georges Marchais managed not to see the tide turning or to refuse to see it turning. He remained faithful till the end to his ideals of youth. He continued to believe that the communist system was the best idea for humanity, and just refused to admit errors on his part or on the part of other brother parties throughout Europe. He remained faithful to Leonid Brezhnev right up to the end. He was a violent critic of Mikhail Gorbachev when he began reforming the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. So he remained really steadfast in his admiration of the communist ideals.
And because of that, did he set back the cause of the left in France?
Very possibly. The electoral scores of the Communist Party plummeted under his stewardship. He really seemed to believe that it was not his fault, it was the fault of the French electorate. So since his departure, yes, his successor, Mr. Robert Hue, has managed to bring some points of the Communist Party program up to date. He was able to forge an alliance once again with the Socialist Party. There are communist ministers in the present socialist government in France. So, yes, there is a certain moving back of the French Communist Party towards the real life of politics in France today.
Philippe Chatenay, foreign editor of L'Evénement de Jeudi, on the death of Georges Marchais, the veteran communist leader, which was announced today. You're listening to the BBC's World Service. Now, it's nearly 13:29 GMT. In a moment, is Gulf Arab support for the US beginning to ebb away? And how to keep a lone killer whale happy? This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. Right now, we'll have a summary of the latest world news from Michael Poles.
One of China's best-known dissidents, Wei Jingsheng, has been released from a 14-year jail term and sent into exile in the United States. The American government and international human rights groups have welcomed the news. The family said he had decided to accept going abroad because of serious health problems. As the American Secretary of State begins talks with Gulf leaders on the crisis over Iraq, Kuwait has said it would oppose military action against Baghdad. Speaking in Cairo, the Kuwaiti foreign minister said any military confrontation would harm the Iraqi people. Clashes have broken out in the West Bank town of Bethlehem between Palestinian youths and Israeli troops. They erupted after the funeral of a 7-year-old Palestinian boy who died yesterday after being shot in the head by an Israeli soldier during incidents earlier in the week. People in Hungary are voting today in a referendum on whether the country should join NATO. Of the three former Warsaw Pact countries being invited to join NATO, only Hungary has decided to make membership subject to a referendum. All the main parties support the Yes campaign. The British Prime Minister Tony Blair has publicly apologised for his government's handling of its decision to exempt Formula One motor racing from a proposed ban on tobacco advertising. There was widespread criticism after it was revealed that the head of Formula One, Bernie Eccleston, had donated £1 million to Mr Blair's Labour Party. The former leader of the French Communist Party, Georges Marchais, has died at the age of 77. The son of a coal miner, he remained faithful to old-style communist dogma throughout his life. Mr. Marchais was party secretary general from 1972 until his retirement 3 years ago. Pope John Paul has opened a synod of 230 Roman Catholic bishops from Latin America, Canada and the United States, the first such meeting of bishops from the Americas. The bishops will advise the Pope on the challenges the Church expects to face in the next century. By the end of today, all but one of the 32 teams at the World Cup finals in France next year will be known. Matches are being played today for the two remaining places in North, Central and South America, and for one in Asia. And that's the summary, Max.
Thanks, Michael. There is just the merest hint of desperation about the way the Americans are trying to garner support for a tough, possibly military, response to Iraq in the row over weapons inspections. The Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, is touring friendly states in the Middle East and Gulf region with somewhat mixed results. And President Clinton has been on the phone to other senior world leaders. His message is clear.
And how important it is for every responsible government in the world to do everything that can possibly be done. Not to let big stores of chemical or biological weapons fall into the wrong hands.
President Clinton thumping the lectern to make his point. But this is not 1991 and the run-up to Desert Storm, and the coalition which held together behind military action then is considerably weaker now. Jordan was one of the few countries which found itself aligned with Saddam Hussein 6 years ago, and again, it's in a difficult position. Our correspondent Raghi Omar asked Jordan's Crown Prince Hassan if Washington has been putting pressure on Arab states to stand against Baghdad.
As far as Jordan is concerned, our position is clear. The respect for the international will has to be there. But at the same time, as far as the use of force is concerned, as those of us living in the area know, friends of the United States and friends of the West, the slowing up of the peace process has meant that the American image is not what it might be. So the use of force as a blunt instrument, I don't think would reflect well at all on the United States at this time.
But you met the Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz, and you said that he conveyed his message more clearly than at any other time. Did you get the sense he was willing to negotiate?
Well, there was a clear sense of frustration over what does full compliance mean, what does substantial compliance mean, what about the timetable for implementation, and the readiness to accept, as he has said so many times more recently, a new initiative in terms of a new examination inspection team. Now, of course, the position, as we know, is pretty clear. Madeleine Albright said very clearly, defiance is not a road to salvation, and recalcitrance can't be rewarded. And I want to say very clearly that one thing we cannot understand is why the parties cannot address the main issue, which for us is the plight of the Iraqi people.
How desperate do you think is that plight?
According to United Nations agencies, let's look at the humanitarian face of the United Nations. We are talking about 5,000 children under the age of five dying every month, as opposed to an average of 400 in 1989.
What do you think is going to happen next when you consider this week of diplomatic activity as spelled out by President Clinton, and also we mentioned Tariq Aziz also traveling through the region to press Iraq's case? What do you think is going to happen next?
Well, I think the possibility, as I said, of a flash conflict exist, and also the possibility of diplomacy being furthered exists against the background of the forthcoming Doha summit or economic conference, and indeed the Organization of the Islamic Conference summit in Tehran. So the timing of the crisis is rather interesting, because if there's going to be an attack against Iraq against the background of these two major regional meetings, and if there's going to be an outcry, and presumably an anti-Western outcry, it's going to be extremely destabilizing. So it's reassuring to know that the strength is there, but that the diplomacy is being used based on the tremendous force deployed in this region.
It's particularly interesting, as you mentioned, all these international fora or fora involving the Arab and Islamic world taking place at the same time that this crisis is going on. Do you think that that's something playing on the mind of President Clinton, to be seen to be attacking Iraq at such a stage?
Indeed, it must be a factor in his mind, and I think that President Clinton is extremely sensitive to human politics, not only in terms of the United States, but in terms of this region. And I see good coming out of bad in terms of a greater focus on the region, broadly defined.
The international community has made it quite clear that they're not going to have any dealings with an Iraq led by President Saddam Hussein. Do you think that they ought to have finished or should finish what they didn't finish at the end of the Gulf War?
Well, today, the international community, particularly the United States and possibly the United Kingdom, are edging towards saying that the direct responsibility lies with the continuation of the rule of Saddam Hussein. And I think the Tariq Aziz's mission was to say, are you talking about sanctions and examination regime, or are you talking about the future of Saddam Hussein? So I think that this crisis is finally going to give a clear indication to everyone that the issue is not purely one of sanctions, but possibly the issue is one of the evolution even of the leadership of Iraq. This is how, at least to today, one is reading the crisis.
Crown Prince Hassan of Jordan. Well, notwithstanding what the Jordanians are saying about the American position, Washington is still trying to drum up support. Ms. Albright has been in the region, but her efforts are looking a bit frustrated. The Kuwaiti foreign minister has made it clear that Kuwait will not support military action. And a number of Arab states had little or no representation at the Middle East and North Africa Economic Conference in Qatar, attended by the American Secretary of State. On the line now from the Qatari capital, Doha, is Gerald Butt, editor of the BBC Arabic magazine. Gerald, with the Kuwaitis now saying that they would not support any military action at this time, has the U.S. got the level of regional backing it would need to launch an attack should it come to that?
I think very unlikely. I think it's very significant that the Kuwaitis are backing out, because up to now they have been the one country in the region, even in the Gulf region, that has said all along that it fully supports American policy, even when some other Gulf countries have demurred a little bit, have questioned what the American policy might involve. The Kuwaitis have always been in line. Therefore, I think it's fair to say that the coalition, such as it was, is really in a state of very, very serious crisis. The Arab sector of that coalition, at any rate.
But isn't it also possible to argue that the Kuwaitis are in a bit of a unique position? I mean, they've already been invaded by Iraq once. They're a small country bordering Iraq. Surely they can't afford to speak out in support of military action, and perhaps it would be expected that they would take a seemingly moderate line at this time.
Well, I think you have to remember that Kuwait is still part of the Arab world, and what's emerging very clearly in the Arab world at the level of leadership as well as at the level of the people, and it's been at the level of people for some time, is some kind of link. It's emerging an emerging link between the suffering of the Iraqi people on the one hand and the plight of the Palestinians on the other. And from Morocco to the Gulf, literally all across the Arab world now, there's a feeling that there is no way that anybody has the stomach for a further American military or Western military activity against Iraq at a time when America appears to be so soft on the Netanyahu government in Israel. There is a real feeling that there isn't stomach for this, that the Iraqi people have suffered enough, and whatever America might have in store, the priority now, as Prince Hassan was alluding to, the priority really should be the Iraqi people.
So, but you're also suggesting that the Americans are suffering now as a result of failing to keep up the momentum in the Middle East peace process.
Yes, the difficulty for the Americans now is that the two major issues in the Middle East that have been two crises that have been bubbling for some years, the Middle East peace process, the whole Arab-Israeli crisis, and the Iraq crisis, have now become interlinked. And they've become interlinked to President Saddam Hussein's advantage. It was indeed he tried to link them during the Gulf War at the time of the invasion of Kuwait. Now, in the minds of the Arab people, these two have become fudged, and it's made the life for Madeleine Albright very, very much more difficult. Viz the fact that she came here to a conference, hardly any Arab allies were here, no Arab foreign ministers except the Qatari foreign minister was here. A very, very embarrassing time for her, and she left as quickly as she could. She can no longer take for granted automatic support that America used to enjoy in the second crisis, the Gulf crisis. She faces as many difficulties here now as she does with the other crisis, the Arab-Israeli. The two have become fudged, and that makes it extremely difficult to disentangle the two.
Gerald Butt, the editor of the BBC's Arabic magazine, live from Doha. Now, what to do with one lonely whale? That's the question facing the aquarium in Vancouver, Canada. One of the facility's two killer whales died recently, and the aquarium would like to get another whale for company. The public opinion, though, is divided, and animal rights groups say the time for keeping whales in captivity is long past. They'd like the aquarium to try releasing the remaining whale. From Vancouver, Ian Gunn reports.
Put your cameras in your eyes in the center of the habitat.
A few dozen people, mainly tourists and many with small children, are laughing and flinching as they're showered by a killer whale that's splashing around the pool at the Vancouver Aquarium. Though few seem to realize it, they're enjoying half the spectacle they might have done a month ago. There were two killer whales here. Now there is just the one, a middle-aged female named Biosa. Clint Wright is the aquarium's curator of marine mammals.
We want to obviously get a companion animal for Biosa as soon as we can. I don't think there's any point in delaying, and so this would be an opportunity for not only for Biosa, but also for a potential companion.
But introducing that companion is tricky business for the aquarium. Public opposition to keeping whales in captivity is growing, and the aquarium's plan is attracting protests from groups like Vancouver's Coalition for No Whales in Captivity. Annalisa Sorg is the group's director.
We would like to see Biosa go into a rehabilitation program such as the one that Keiko, the Free Willy whale, is going through in Oregon. He is scheduled to go into a sea pen of Iceland in the next year, basically, and so that tank will be available for other animals.
That tank is at an American aquarium, where the hope is to recondition captive whales for life in the wild. But it's not a program the Vancouver Aquarium has much faith in, because for all the enthusiasm, Keiko, the star of the Hollywood film Free Willy and the tank's first customer, hasn't yet learned to eat live fish. Clint Wright again.
He's nuzzling those fish and playing with them, and that's been 2 years. He hasn't killed one yet, so what is the point? They've spent $2-3 million on trying to release this animal.
That money the Vancouver Aquarium maintains could be much better spent on both wild and captive whales elsewhere. Still, activists say release has to be tried, and another whale, like Biosa, might fare better. She's unlikely to be allowed to try. The aquarium says she's more valuable to both science and public education where she is now. And as long as crowds continue to come and see her, protests are unlikely to change its mind. And so chances are Biosa will remain in her Vancouver tank, probably with another whale, and almost certainly the center of continued controversy.
So, on behalf of the Marine Mammal staff and the National Security at the Aquarium, we'd like to thank you for joining us this afternoon.
And that report from Vancouver was by Ian Gunn. It's nearly 13:43 GMT. Still to come in this edition of the program, we'll have today's sports news and cleaning up New York's sleazy 42nd Street. But is the result all a bit too clean? You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. Reminder of the main news today. China has released one of its best-known political dissidents and sent him into exile in the U.S. And as the American Secretary of State begins talks with Gulf leaders on the crisis over Iraq, Kuwait has said it would oppose military action against Baghdad. The people of Hungary are voting today in a referendum on whether to join NATO. The government has lobbied hard for a yes vote. Those opposed argue that the costs of beefing up Hungary's defense commitments to meet NATO requirements are too high. On the streets of Budapest today, voters queuing to cast their ballots reflected the division.
I voted yes, because I think that in this region and at this time, independence is unimaginable. And I think that in the long term, it's a cheaper and more affordable solution.
I think it's a dangerous business, this NATO. Historically, too, I don't think Hungary's position would be any happier if we joined NATO.
First, it felt strange to vote yes for a military organization, but I feel that there was no other choice, and it was rather an obligatory yes than a positive yes.
Because this is a small country and all our neighbours hate us, NATO means bitter defence.
Some views from the streets of Budapest today, and joining us now live from there is our correspondent Nick Thorpe. Nick, the government had feared that a low turnout could undermine the attempt to join NATO. At this stage, what does the turnout look like?
Well, the latest figures we've got are only from 11 this morning, and then 20% had already voted. So turnout is looking a bit better than expected, and it I think it will go over 50%.
And just to be clear, there is a particular hurdle in terms of the numbers of votes cast which has to be crossed before the referendum is valid.
That's right, it's a peculiar one. One in four, 25%, that means 2 million out of the 8 million registered voters have to vote one way or the other. So 2 million votes yes or 2 million no, or 2 million votes no for the vote to be valid.
Is there any chance that it could be undecided at the end of today? I mean, what did the opinion polls suggest would be the outcome in the run-up to today's voting?
The opinion polls were suggesting round about 60-65% yes and around about a solid 25% no. And the last, that was right up to the last minute. And the very final opinion poll gave even higher than that, a sort of 70% yes. So it's looking quite likely.
Have the Hungarian people been given a fair crack at the argument, so to speak? I mean, I guess because the government is in favour of the yes vote, there has been perhaps more propaganda in favour of the yes vote than against.
That's certainly the case, and not only is the government in favour, but all the opposition parties in Parliament are also in favour, which has meant a rather one-sided election referendum campaign. The two parties against the a small left-wing, a small right-wing, and many pacifist and environmental groups, they haven't had much chance, really, until the last moment. They've rather been defacing other people's pro-posters than being able to launch a campaign of their own.
And is the argument against simply based on the costs of increased defence spending, or is it also about whether Hungary should be a westward or an eastward-looking country?
There is a lot of talk about the cost, but there are also questions of neutrality. The only foreign policy demand of the 1956 revolution in Hungary was for neutrality, and some people still feel rather nostalgic towards that. Why should we join another military alliance so soon after escaping from the Warsaw Pact?
The final question, I mean, I'm curious about this. Why is there a referendum in Hungary in the first place on this issue? Because of the other countries up for NATO membership at this time, Poland and the Czech Republic, there's no referendum. The matter there is to be decided by Parliament. Why a referendum at all?
This was there are rather political reasons behind this than moral or ethical ones. The governing Socialist Party made a pledge in its 1994 election manifesto to hold a referendum. At that time, it looked more likely that Hungary would join the European Union first, before NATO. The military alliance seems to have got its act together quicker in terms of European enlargement. This has caught the governing Socialists rather off balance, and therefore I think they felt they had to follow up their pledge rather reluctantly. They've put a brave face on it, but they didn't especially want to hold this, but they felt they'd promised it, and so it had to go ahead.
Nick Thorpe in Budapest, thank you. In Rome, the Pope has opened a special month-long gathering of Catholic bishops from North and South America. This synod has been called to look at a wide range of problems facing the Catholic Church in the Americas, ranging from debates over homosexuality and the celibacy of the priesthood in the U.S. to birth control and the spread of rival strands of Christianity in Latin America. I asked Cardinal Bernard Law from Denver, Colorado, who's in Rome for the gathering, if this is a difficult time for the Catholic Church.
Well, it's a difficult time, but it's also a very challenging and hopeful time. And I think that the Synod itself indicates a very positive phenomenon, that there is a fundamental unity in the Church which cuts across many differences that one finds in America.
Well, a lot of the issues facing North America are, for example, not the same as those facing Catholics in South America. I mean,
I'm not sure I would agree with that.
Well, look at a few of them, the role of women and so forth, whether the priesthood should be allowed to marry, the role of homosexuals. These are issues which are to the fore in North America, and perhaps in South America, poverty, contraception, and the rise of evangelical...
I would say that the underlying issue facing both the Church in North and South America is how do we more effectively live out the communion of faith that is ours. And many of the issues that you speak of flow out of the Americanization of popular culture. And I would see that as a challenge in many ways, not only to North and South America, speaking for the Church, but also for the Church worldwide.
What is this synod going to do, then? What achievements will flow from it, do you think?
Well, it's very difficult to say. We'll be in session for a month, and I believe it's difficult to predict what comes out of a synod, because the very nature of it as a meeting in faith is that we will be open to God's Spirit as we try to come to some helpful suggestions to the Holy Father, which is the purpose of the Synod, concerning the Church in America.
The Catholic Church, as we know, is preparing itself for the next millennium. Privately, are bishops preparing themselves for the next pontificate? Because we know that the present Pope's views on a number of issues are, you know, well documented and fairly rigid. They are not likely to change in his lifetime.
No, I would say that we're preparing ourselves for the next millennium. And that will include, I suppose, several pontificates. But we're in this pontificate. And I would not characterize this pontificate as rigid over and against something else that might be expected. I think that the fidelity to the deposit of faith is what will be constant. And people who think that there's going to be a change in that are bound to be disappointed.
Is the Catholic Church in North and South America in trouble?
No, I don't think it's in trouble at all. I think that society in North and South America is in trouble, and I think that our task is to see how do we serve in solidarity our brothers and sisters more effectively. There's altogether too much of a difference between North and South in terms of economy. There's altogether too much a yielding to an individualism run amok, and a loss of a sense of human solidarity.
Cardinal Bernard Law from Denver, Colorado, who's attending the Catholic Bishop's Synod in Rome. Today's sports news now, here's Sumant Bhatia.
Well, thanks, Max. And it's been an exciting year in tennis with many new players breaking into the top flight. But the final of the ATP Tour World Championship, the lucrative and prestigious tournament reserved for the world's top eight players, features two relative veterans, the top seed, America's Pete Sampras, and the number five, Yevgeny Kafelnikov of Russia. With the latest from the match in the German city of Hanover, here's Richard Evans.
Yes, Yevgeny Kafelnikov only making this tournament by dint of winning the Kremlin Cup in Moscow just 2 days before it started. Otherwise, he wouldn't have made the last eight. He's come through the round-robin format and yesterday's semi-final against Carlos Moyra of Spain to be facing the world number one, Pete Sampras, and the first set got off to a very turbulent start. Pete Sampras started disastrously, double-faulting to lose his opening service game, and we wondered whether he was back to the kind of form he'd shown against Carlos Moyra so abysmally, that kind of form in the first round-robin match. But then he broke Kafelnikov's serve in the second game, and then, amazingly, serves were swapped once again. Sampras led 3-1, only to drop serve for the Russian to draw level for 3-all. And then at 4-3 to Sampras, he struck again. Some brilliant service returns, the backhand working so much better than it had been earlier in the week, and Kafelnikov cramped so often on his two-handed backhand, unable to handle the velocity of the Sampras returns, dropped his serve for the third time in this first set, and Sampras served out for it 6-3.
And that was Richard Evans in Hanover. And it's congratulations to Italy, Yugoslavia, Croatia and Belgium. They're the last four qualifiers from Europe for football's World Cup finals next year after winning their playoff ties. Now the spotlight's on Asia. South Korea and Saudi Arabia have made it to France 98 by winning their groups. But as we speak, the runners-up Iran and Japan are playing a one-off game in Johor Bahru in Malaysia for another place. It's half-time, and with the latest from the ground is Michael Church.
Yeah, Japan had just taken the lead about 5 minutes before the end of the first half through Masashi Nakayama when he latched onto Hidetoshi Nakata's through ball and slipped it under Abid Zade in the Iranian goal. Iran have played quite well, but Japan deserved the lead. They played some nice passing football. Iran are struggling to fit into the new system they're playing, but things are going reasonably well for Japan.
And what about the crowd? Is it mostly Japanese, or have we got any Iranian supporters there as well?
There's a handful, but we have 22,500 Japanese fans who are getting behind the team, and when the Iranians go forward, things get a little bit quiet.
Thanks again for that, Michael Church. That was Michael Church, who's in Johor Bahru in Malaysia. And the loser of that game gets one more chance to qualify in a two-legged playoff game against Australia for the 32nd and last place in the finals. Well, that's the sports news.
Thanks, Sir Matt. Well, a new musical has just opened in New York. Nothing extraordinary in that, except that The Lion King, a Disney production, hit the stage on 42nd Street, which until a few years ago was a red light district. Now, most of the sex shops and the drug dealers are gone, and the area around 42nd Street and Times Square has become New York's main center for family entertainment. Henri Astier reports.
42nd Street sounds much the same as it ever did, with its steady flow of impatient cabs and wailing sirens. But the area certainly looks different from a few years ago. Not a striptease parlor, not a seedy hotel in sight. The streets are clean and lined with toy stores. This may as well be called Disneyland on the Hudson. Most New Yorkers are impressed.
I think it's looking better.
We're cleaning it up at least.
Would you come here with your kid?
Yeah. During the day, yeah.
My kids would have to take me during the day because they're bigger than me.
People of all ages can indeed have good, clean fun in Times Square these days. Multi-million dollar entertainment complexes are springing up. One will soon feature a branch of Madame Tussauds' Wax Museum. Tourists are flocking to the area like never before. Randy Levine, New York's deputy mayor in charge of economic affairs, says the whole city is benefiting from the cleanup.
It is the symbol of the reemergence of New York City as one of the safest, one of the most economically successful cities in the world. On an economic level, it's a tremendous boon for the city because it's created a lot of new jobs. It has become a magnet for worldwide corporations and theaters. For example, Disney now has a huge presence on 42nd Street.
Walt Disney's latest stage musical, The Lion King, has just opened on 42nd Street, and it's booked up for months. The venue, the New Amsterdam Theatre, is a symbol of what's happened to the whole area in recent years. It was once one of New York's great theatres, but it fell on hard times in the 1970s and 80s. Then the Walt Disney Company took it over. Peter Schneider is head of animation at Disney.
About 15 years ago, it became a movie theatre with pornos, live-action sort of movies going in there. And then about 7 years ago, it really fell into disrepair. The ceiling was open, the water gushed in, the stench and disaster was pretty extensive when we first took it over 3 years ago, and decided to restore it back to its original beauty and luster with the original plaster. The murals are back in. It's now become a beautiful showcase for Broadway theater.
Not everybody on 42nd Street is happy about the cleanup. If you look hard, you'll spot a handful of sex shops and peep shows holding out against the onslaught of Mickey Mouse and his wholesome cohorts. Chevalier Di Serrano works at one of the surviving adult theaters.
Walt Disney kissed my ass. Because of him, I had mad friends unemployed, two cousins out of work. Now, a lot of these females got men. They got no other means to support their kids. Hey, all of a sudden, along comes somebody who says, well, what you're doing is wrong, and we have to take it down because we're going to put up shit for cartoon mice. I mean, how corny does that sound? And he's going to have to go sling some crack, you know, do drug deal, because, you know, there's a million and one ways to make money on the street. Then he's going to have to go through illegal means to come buy that bread, and then meanwhile he's being put through the system, gets arrested and all that. For what?
Of course, you wouldn't expect those who work in the peep show business to welcome the cleanup, any more than turkeys can be trusted to vote for Christmas. But some ordinary New Yorkers, too, have mixed feelings about the new Times Square. Nancy Melcher is a longtime Manhattan resident.
Well, it's cleaner, it's safer, but I don't like it. It's too sanitary. There's no personality, and you could be anywhere in mid-country USA.
Most New Yorkers, however, do not miss the old Times Square. It seems the Lion King will reign here for the foreseeable future.
And that report from Henri Astier in New York brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. This is Max Pearson in London. Until the next time, from all of us here, thanks for listening. Goodbye. We'll be right back.
reminder that NewsHour is broadcast twice daily at 13 hours and 19 hours, Greenwich Mean Time.